So, for this evening's talk, I wanted to discuss arguments, because it's part of your week, I'm sure, that someone has had an argument with you. You've had an argument back, and if it's a close friend or if it's a loved one, sometimes, maybe all the time, we feel terrible about it afterwards. It sours our relationship, leaves a bad taste in the mouth. We feel bad and we wonder what the heck is going on with life that we always have these arguments. So I wanted to talk about the nature of arguments and the solution so that they're not painful anymore. Obviously the solution is not having everybody agree with me. That would be wonderful if there's no arguments and they all realize your great wisdom and your infallibility, just like the Pope. But unfortunately, you're only your husband, you're only your wife, you're not the Pope, and you haven't got a direct line to truth. But nevertheless, sometimes you think you do. And we have arguments, and it leaves a terrible, terrible relationship. But why? What's going on? And what can we do about this? So today's talk is about arguments. But first of all, I wanted to investigate why arguments. Why do they come about anyway? What's the source of these arguments? And for me, it was a journey which I thought, my goodness, why can't everybody see the truth like I see it? It's obvious I'm right. And I think you all think the same as me. It's obvious that you're right, but why is it that people see things in a totally different way? And it was only when I started looking at the teachings of Buddhism, where because Buddhism is a very much a meditative tradition, where the teachings and the truths are not found in books but come from the human mind, which is focused in the clarity and depth of deep meditation, that those insights which come up from looking inside of yourself rather than looking inside of books reveal some incredible insights into why we argue. It's why we actually come to these conclusions, why we think like we do. You've probably heard monks, nuns like me talk about like conditioning, just brainwashing, just the way we come to a conclusion. And when you actually see the whole process, where your thoughts come from, then you understand why we have different thoughts and where those arguments find their root. Why do you think like you do? And you find if you trace back your thoughts, you find that yes, you too are a creature of conditioning. You too have been brainwashed. It's not your thoughts. It's a result of all those experiences that you have been exposed to over a long, long period of time. Ever since you go to school, that's where the brainwashing begins. If you go to Christian school, Buddhist school, Islamic school, by the time you just come out of those institutions, you're already brainwashed to think that Buddhism is by far the best religion. It's obvious. If you go to, imagine if they had, instead of like Christian schools or Islamic schools, imagine if you had liberal schools or labour schools or green schools run by the political parties. What a wonderful idea that would be if we had the Labour Party deciding to actually put their money into creating Labour schools where the kids are turned out to be unionists and Labour sort of politicians, because you can brainwash kids that way. And obviously you think that's terrible, so why do we actually send our children to religious schools? And I was actually right behind Richard Dawkins when he said this was actually a clear offence against human rights. A child should have the right to choose. And really, school should empower a child to choose, not take away that choice, by the brainwashing and conditioning in their early life. Because, why do you think like you do? A lot of that is because of your conditioning. Let's take an interesting case. Why, if somebody says, if I said, oh, my mother died yesterday, she hasn't died, she's still alive, this is just a metaphor. I've got to be very careful what I say, because as soon as I say something, now I just coughed, I think, a couple of weeks ago, and the word got around that I was dying, I had some terrible disease. And they started asking me, sort of, is Ajahn Brahm going to live, or is it terminal? It was only a cough! For goodness sake, so I've got to be very careful. But my mum is, okay, but if I said my mother died, then what would you say? You'd say, oh, that's so sad. What do you mean it's sad? Why do people say such things? Oh, it's so sad. Oh, it's such a shame. It's a terrible thing. It might be wonderful that my mother died. She'd be free of her suffering. But you can see how we have conditioned responses to the events in life. I might get a nice little fluffy little kitten out of my bag and show it to you, and you'll go, ah, isn't that sweet? Where did that come from? That little kitten might have just pooed in my bag. But why do you always say, ah, isn't it sweet? Do you know where those responses came from? You've been conditioned, you've learned those responses. And one of those responses which I've seen people learn, and this shows how our thoughts actually do get conditioned by our upbringing, is because part of my job is actually to conduct Buddhist funeral services, and also Christian funeral services as well. I've been booked by even non-Buddhists. They say they like my funeral services, even though I'm not a Buddhist, they want me to do their funeral service for them. And of course, one of those reasons is because we don't charge, so they get it very cheap. And that's one of the reasons why people like Buddhism in the West. Because monks don't have money, we don't charge for anything. We undercut prices. But anyhow, that by the way, that because I've done many, 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 many funeral services, I've just noticed sometimes that when little children come into the service, they're just full of energy and full of life. They run around, they play, they joke, and they laugh. And I've seen the adults say, be quiet, shut up. And I've seen those little children, just their face show confusion, and then be quiet and be sad because they're taught that that's what you have to do when you go to a funeral ceremony. I've seen for so many years now how we condition our children to be sad when somebody dies. It is not natural, it's imposed upon us. And I also noticed, having spent 9 years in a place in our world in northeast Thailand which was not affected by colonial powers. The British were in the south in Malaysia, the French were north over in Laos and Cambodia. And but the Brits or the French, the major powers in that area, they left out that part of Thailand. Thailand was very smart in playing those powers against each other, so it was never invaded, never colonized. So I managed to live in an area which was real, pure Buddhist philosophy. It hadn't been infected by any influence from the West. And one of the things which I saw there was the absence of grief when a person died. No one cried or felt sad when somebody passed away. And there were some tragic cases of people dying. And I noticed that for 9 years because our monastery was one of the main funeral places. People would bring their bodies there once a week, maybe twice a week, there'd always be a funeral. And the people who were the relations of the people who had died, you see them the next day, you talk to them, you see them the next week. And I was watching for the tears, I was watching for the sadness, and it just wasn't there. After 9 years, I came to the conclusion that there was no grief. Loss, yes, but grief. So where does grief come from? I learned from that experience that grief is not a natural result of a loss. If it was natural, everybody would have it. and there was a society which was isolated from external influences, which did not exhibit that grief. It was weird, but it was true, and I understood why, because from the very early times, their conditioning, their training, what they'd been taught by their peers, their parents, their grandparents, was to accept that life is lost, but don't worry about it, don't grieve, don't carry around that burden of pain. They could let their loved ones go, even if it was children, even if it was like a wife, a dear husband or whatever, they could let it go. What I learned there was that some of even the way we look at life is actually conditioned, we're told this, we're taught this, other people reinforce it. The way we look at life, our world views, are very much built up in our early years of life by our culture, by our parents, by all these influences which are put upon us, and there are so many of them, we just don't realize just how much we are each brainwashed into looking at life in a certain way and not another way. So if you are coming from an Islamic culture, from a Christian culture, from a Buddhist culture, you will already be almost forced to see things in a certain way. Now the interesting thing, to me anyway, when I first understood this, is just how no matter where you start, no matter what view you have, no matter where you've actually been brainwashed, how that is self-reinforcing. And when I saw that, that was really dangerous. You may have the most stupid, ridiculous view, which is totally against reality. Say, for example, those people, and I think you'll understand that this is just not a religious view, these are people who view the world in a totally dysfunctional way. I'm talking about people who have episodes of schizophrenia. And what they actually see, I remember reading an article of a person describing their battle with schizophrenia and just how they came out the other side, just wise, free, living a beautiful life. And they said that it was so extreme that sometimes they would see like heads, dismembered heads, rolling around the floor in front of them. Visions which were totally irrational, illogical, which couldn't actually exist. But to them, it was obviously true. That there was no way that they could doubt the logic, the reason of a dismembered head rolling in front of them on the ground. And I can understand that, yeah, how that works. Once you have a certain worldview, once you really think that that is actually the truth, that actually bends your perceptions. Perceptions is the raw data which get into your mind, which don't fit, get denied. They get pushed out. You just don't see them. And every type of perception which fulfills, meets the demands, which justifies your view, will be allowed in to your mind. So, you view that that's possible, you perceive it happening, and it's obviously, it just justifies itself. A good way of looking at that, another way, which is less extreme. Do you have enemies? Do you have some people you just do not like? Do you have some people, you know, some people are really cool and they've hurt you and they've hurt many other people? You know that many people love those people. Sometimes you may look at, let's look at a case in point in our modern day, Muammar Gaddafi. Do you like President Gaddafi of Libya? He's got many people who love him, who think he's a bee's knees. How can that be? How can you love a person like that? And I think most of you, if you've been watching the news or if you've been reading the newspapers, I think you'll have the opinion that someone like Muammar Gaddafi, the current president of Libya, or prime minister, or leader, whatever he is a really bad fellow, and the sooner we get rid of him, the better. That may be true, I don't know, I've never met the guy, but I know that that view has now been conditioned into me as it's been conditioned into you. And it's quite surprising that sometimes you see people with a total opposite opinion. Now I'm asking you, who's right and who's wrong? Well, let's ask an even better question than that. Not who's right and who's wrong, but why do you think like that? And why do other people think directly opposite to what you think? So it's not saying who's right and who's wrong, because that's an endless, fruitless exercise. Instead, why do you think like that? Why do other people think otherwise? Why do sometimes you have an enemy? And you're sure, from your experience, that person is a B-A-S-T-R-D, that they don't deserve any kindness. They should be thrown in some jail cell, locked away and never released. Why do you think like that? And why do other people think that they're just a wonderful person, so much so that they'll marry that person, they'll just look after them, they think they're so good? Why? Are they missing something? Are you missing something? And of course you are. What's actually happening here is that you've actually formed a view, an opinion. And everything which you see, which you read, which you allow into your mind, is only going to reinforce that view. And that means you get into this self-justifying cycle. If you hate somebody, and you see them, and they say, good morning, you think, what do they mean by that? What are they trying to get? They're trying to get something out of me for sure. Do you see just how they said something which might even be kind? They're wishing you good morning, but because you hate them, because they're your enemy, straight away, the mind just cannot admit that they're a good person, because you've already formed that black and white view, they're my enemy, I hate them, they're terrible, they're nasty, they're angry, they're mean. How can they be good? And because of that, any kindness, your mind will twist around to justify, yes, I was right. They are an enemy. They're not worth liking. And it's amazing just how many people are like that. In my book, Open the Door of Your Heart, I made a point by repeating a poem which I heard a long time ago. Because I used to like poetry. And this poet... this piece of poetry really inspired me. And especially because it's Mother's Day soon, isn't it? I think next month? When is Mother's Day? 8th of May. Remember Mother's Day, everybody, because, you know, your mother's really important. And this was a poem about a son's love for her mother, and just how important it is to love your mum. And it was actually a very beautiful poem, and I remember part of it was saying, when your mother grows old, you know, especially when she can't walk, you know, lend her a hand. You know, if she can't do things by herself, you just, you know, you help her. And if she gets a bit grumpy and speaks to you unkindly, never get angry back. If she sort of scolds you twice, you know, just take it. She's your mum. And even if she asks you 3 times, answer her, but not with anger back, only with gentleness and kindness. Because she's your mother, and the day will come, it's a very sad day, when your mother can answer you no more, when she dies. So please always care for your mum. That was the gist of the poem. It was written far more eloquently than that. But the thing which really stood out in that poem was its author. It's a beautiful poem of how you should love your mother, and it was written by a man called Adolf Hitler. And that just really sort of, when you read that, it totally challenges your idea that a person who we have been conditioned to believe is one of the most evil men who's ever lived, it conditions you to think, hey, how can an evil person like that say something so beautiful? It's challenging our views about how we look at the world, how we look at people, how we'll even look at religion. How much are you really conditioned? Most of you are Buddhist. And I'm sure most of you think that Buddhism is the most wonderful religion. Is that justifiable? Is that true? There are many other people this evening going to sort of revival meetings for Christians, going to the mosque, and they think that theirs is the best religion. Why? And it's because we start with this view. And once we have a view, anything which challenges our view, even you Buddhists, you don't admit it into your head. Anything which supports it, you let that in. It's called sort of denial in psychology. Anything you don't want to see, you don't like hearing, you don't hear. You just don't see. You twist it. Our views are so strong, you don't realize just how they bend. They bend the world to fit your views. That is why, some time ago, I made a very quick and easy definition of what true religion, what true spiritual path is. What really you should be following if you really want to arrive at something which has a real meaning, which you can rely upon. And those two types of paths or religions or spiritual quests, I say the first one is what bends the truth to fit your views or faith. And many people do that. They bend the truth to fit in to your faith, to your views, to the way you want to look at the world. And the other one, the way that we should really be practicing, if we're honest to truth, we really want to find out and be sincere, is to bend the faith, bend your views to fit the truth. So any view you have, any idea you have, any faith which you have, be willing to sacrifice that so you can actually see the truth. One of the other things I said, never let your learning or your experience stand in the way of truth. There's so many people have learning. They're the professors, they're the experts, maybe the monks, the theologians. I don't know what you're good at, what you have learned, what your area of expertise is. But how many times have you been so expert that you haven't seen the truth? That your knowledge, your expertise has stood in the way of truth. You just can't see it. Why? Because you know too much. You know what it should be, so you don't see what's truly there. That's why, again, the graffiti which was written in Cambridge when I was a student was very, not just witty, but it was also deep with its meaning. And one of my favourite pieces of graffiti at that time, in 1969-70, was scrawled on the walls of the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge. "The eminence of a great scientist," it read. Their eminence is measured by the length of time. They obstruct progress in their field. Now, the reason that you are laughing there is because you recognize the truth of that statement. The more eminent that professor is, the more expert they are, the more they will hold on to their views. They're the knowledgeable ones, they're the experts, and they won't allow any progress because that challenges them, who they are, their insights. I still remember, just from those days in sight, one of the most famous photographs, I think taken in maybe 1949 or 50, of the great sort of Einstein just arguing with the great quantum physicist Niels Bohr. You could see as they were walking through the streets of Copenhagen, arguing with each other. Einstein was the famous guy. Bohr was the upstart. And Niels Bohr eventually got the better of Einstein. Quantum physics was true. Einstein famously said, "God doesn't play dice." Unfortunately, they do play dice. But he was so eminent. Einstein! How could Einstein be wrong? But my goodness, he was. And that's what we mean by the eminence of a scientist. The ego of a scientist stands in the way of truth. Your ego. How many people here have got no ego? Of course, you all have the ego. That's why you will defend your views, sometimes to the death. Well, maybe not to the death, but sometimes it gets pretty close. Now you can understand that if we don't see where our views come from, that they are just conditioned things. It's just, the best drink in the world, it's not beer, it's not latte, it's tea. Good, strong English tea with a bit of condensed milk. I mean, can't you guys see that? Now, where does that come from? Because my conditioning, I was born in England, made in England, it says on my tattoo inside. I haven't got that, I should get one day. But it's my conditioning, that's why I like that stuff. And I can't change that, it's just conditioning, that's all. You can see where your likes and dislikes come from. It's not just likes and dislikes, it's much deeper than that. It's your even world views. Sometimes you don't realize just how much that your way you think, the way you look at life, has been already set just by the conditioning which you've had in your past. And because we've all had different conditionings, that means that we are doomed to argue. We will never agree with each other. That's just a great relief to know that. You will never agree with me. So that means I don't need to keep on trying to convince you. I can let go and let you be stupid. Or let me be stupid, I don't know. But you can see what happens once you allow arguments to exist, differences to exist. It means we don't have to invest so much time and effort and emotional capital of convincing another person they are wrong and convincing ourselves that I am right. We don't have to do that anymore. We can disagree. Whoopee. Because the problem with disagreements, it's not the disagreements, it's what we do about it. Sometimes we fight about the different views we have in the world. Sometimes we try just to use all sorts of mean, unsocial, violent means of convincing others. That is the problem. Not the disagreements, that's natural. That has to happen, that's part of the world. But what we do with the disagreements, that is where we can do a lot to solve some of the pain, the misery and the violence in the world. So we give up trying to convince other people. We can still argue. And I remember just when I was growing up, maybe this was a culture I was in. In those days, I mean, friendship and working together was much more important than being ego and being sort of... The self was not so important where I grew up. There was much more working together, being friends together, not being so much individualistic and self-centered and working out your own desires and what your own needs are, but just being much more other-centered rather than just me, or what I usually say here, more us-centered rather than I-centered. So I remember just, especially growing up with your friends, you know, we were investigating the world. We wanted to challenge. We wanted to learn. So arguments were one of the greatest ways of moving our understanding and our knowledge forward. So the arguments were never ever about who's right and who's wrong. The arguments were about we're all learning, all challenging each other, so we can actually get a greater and deeper understanding and knowledge of the world. So, you know, we used to argue for fun. I remember many, many evenings, before I even went to college, but especially when I was at university, many evenings going to a pub or a bar with your friends. We'd have great arguments, arguments about everything. You know, philosophy, you know, religion, politics, sport. We would argue, and the arguments were passionate, and they have to be passionate. Please put passion into your life. Especially compassion, that's the best passion of all, but don't just do things half-hearted. So we'd really go at it. And we'd be excited, emotional. That was important. That gave it power. I know a long time ago, one monk said to me, he said, look, if you're going to give a talk passionately, something you really enjoy and believe in, which is important to you. And then that sort of engages other people. So when I give talks, it's something which I really find important, I'm passionate about, and that actually is a great way of giving a public talk. If you've got no passion about what you're saying, then you sit here and you try and get rid of the talk as soon as possible, watching the clock so you can get away, you speak in a monotone and everybody falls asleep because you've got no interest in what you're saying, and then no one's got interest in what you're saying either. That's not the way to give talks. Passionate, so you believe in what you're saying. So we used to have these great arguments, but they were framed in kindness and friendship. It wasn't diminishing the other person. It wasn't putting anybody down. It wasn't raising up your ego. Because the egos, the persons weren't important. We were just trying to find out some truth. So because the egos weren't important, because no one was trying to sort of win just to show just how clever they were, because no one ever felt diminished afterwards, we were friends before the argument, we were friends afterwards. And the rule which I had with my friends, whoever won the argument, they had to buy the next round of drinks. And what that actually meant, that it was couched in this beautiful sense of trust and friendship. So when you have arguments, even in a family, please remember to couch it. No, to embrace it in the sense that, yeah, we're lovers, we're friends, we're family, okay? Now that's number one priority. And no matter how much we're passionate in an argument, it's understood. Maybe we could actually set that as a very clear message to begin with. No matter how passionate I am with my argument, it doesn't mean I don't care about you, I don't love you, I don't respect you. I do, okay? That's a given. So if, no matter how I say, it's a foolish argument, it's a stupid thing you said, I still care about you, I still love you. Because what happens when most people argue, it's taken personally, it's taken that, you know, I really am an idiot, you don't respect me at all, you know, you don't even sort of listen to my views, you don't respect me, you're diminishing me, I'm a nobody, and you're just some sort of clever clogs or whatever it is. And that means the argument never works. It becomes personal, it becomes negative, we feel horrible about it afterwards. It's not that we shouldn't argue. We should argue in the right way. And that means, you know, setting the parameters, the boundaries of friendship. And saying, look, I'm going to be passionate with this argument, but I care about you, I respect you, I love you. Interestingly, that I managed to create those parameters with a friend which I actually miss, and that was Abbot Placid of the Benedictine Monastery in Eunuchia. It took a long while for us to actually establish that trust. You know, actually, because, you know, he was a Christian abbot, you know, Benedictine, a Catholic, I'm a Buddhist monk. And the first time we went up there to Eunuchia, it was just that we had a visiting monk from Thailand and we were just looking for some place to take him. You know, just for an afternoon, let's go see another monastery. And they were just very welcoming. And from that just opening, you know, we started doing things together, and we started having this meeting with each other once a year. They'd come down to Bodhinyana Monastery, the whole gang of them, and you know, we'd go to their monastery, just the monks. So we'd actually talk to each other. We get to know each other as actually real friends. There's not that many monks, you know, in Western Australia. So it doesn't matter they're Catholic and, you know, they're sort of Buddhists. We were monks. And that gave us so much in common. Especially, there's only two abbots in Western Australia. You know, Abbot Bodhi, actually, let's say the nuns' monastery, but that was very small in those days. You know, myself and the abbot of the Benedictine monastery. And it's amazing just how much we had in common. You know, the sort of problems which I face. You've got no one else to talk. No one knows what it's like to be an abbot, because you don't know what it's like to be an abbot. You don't know what it's like to be a monk. But, you know, this guy did, because he was the abbot of a monastery. I was the abbot of a monastery. You had these great discussions. And then that friendship really took off. And then we could really challenge each other. And that was when it was really interesting. Because I was a Buddhist, he was a Christian, coming from a very different background. But we could actually ask the toughest questions of each other, passionately, But there was that trust there. Look, I don't matter how what you say about me or what you tell me, even if you say I'm an absolutely fool, I know that you were my friend before this conversation, you'll be my friend afterwards. That's a given. And no one's going to take that away. And nothing you say can take that away. And because of that trust and friendship was there, we had some marvellous discussions. And actually that allowed me to change some of my views. Because, you know, I was actually conditioned to being a Buddhist. And I actually, when I first understood just how that conditioning, how your views, how your influences, what you actually allow yourself to listen to, who you allow yourself to be, does make my thoughts. That's where my thoughts come from. I realize I have to actually be much wider in my friendship. I had to cultivate deliberately non-Buddhist friends. Just like you may be a Buddhist, and you may be sort of just have Buddhist friends, and just come here and on a Friday night and just go just listen to the talks on the website and just go out to dinner with Buddhist friend, marry a Buddhist, and just go to Buddhist retreats. That is unhealthy. Have a few Christian friends as well, a few Muslim friends, a few atheist friends. They're going to keep you honest. They're going to ask you the tough questions. They're also going to influence you. And I deliberately did that because I didn't want to be a brainwashed Buddhist. I didn't want to be sort of an extremist, a fundamentalist who just gets Buddhist ideas put into them and nothing else. So I deliberately cultivated sort of people who would challenge me. You know, that's one of the nicest places I went to was prisons. When you first go into a prison in Western Australia, they told me, I mean, the first time I went to prison, it was actually down in Bunbury, but I started going to Fremantle Prison when it was still open. And I remember this guy came up to us and I was going to sit around a table and talk to him, and he said, look, we don't care who you are, but in this jail, no BS, BULLSHIT. I'm still not game enough to say that word, but you know what I mean. That's what they said to me. Because this is a prison. There's a sense of honesty in here, straightforwardness. You tell it how you feel, you be honest, and we'll listen to you. You try and just make up or just be something you're not, and just you might as well walk out of here because we won't listen and accept you. And I really respected that. Thank you. That's the sort of people I love talking with. Straightforward. It's not just going to listen and accept because I'm a monk, some sort of priest which you have to follow no matter what. It's not just respecting me because I've got a robe on and a bald head because I've been ordained for so many years, but what are you actually saying? Be truthful. So when I allowed myself to actually to be influenced by so many different people, I thought that was much safer. So I couldn't be actually stuck in one particular type of view and have that being self-justified all the time. So with those sorts of people, that friendship was there from the beginning. With Abbot Placid, the friendship was there. So we could argue. We could argue passionately. And I found that's actually where I learned so much from. If you're listening to me today, if you listen to me a lot, it's nothing to do with me. It's the conditioning which I've got, the training which I've had, and what I've actually allowed myself to learn through all those years, to be in controversy. I've also loved going to conferences. Because when you go to conferences, you give your speech, but then comes question times afterwards. And quite often that people have come up to that microphone and they've harangued me. Ajahn Brahm, you can't say that. It says in the sutta, so it says somewhere else, so that's wrong. And this is, thank you so much. Because you're actually giving me that input to be a much better sort of monk and speaker in the future. And I've accepted those harangues, those arguments. Because I know it's in the spirit of friendship. It's not just putting a person down for putting them down. We want to take truth deeper. To make it sort of more profound. So, one, arguments, you'll never get rid of them. They are part of life. They're part of marriage. They're there, okay? Accept them. Couch them in friendship. Which means after the argument, there's no bitter taste. There's no sense of, she hates me, she doesn't respect me, he never listens to me. There's never that negativity, which is the problem with arguments. And it's never that necessity to always be right. The argument is not sort of about being right or wrong, it's like a work in progress. It's discovery in action. You are learning more, you are going deeper, you are being challenged, you are understanding more. The arguments actually are good for you, they take you deeper. And both sides will always benefit, and both sides will learn. So who's right and who's wrong? I mentioned this a few weeks ago. Great master Ajahn Chah, sometimes what I take an hour to say, he would just sum up in just, you know, 1 second with these pithy statements. He said, when there is an argument, he said, one side is right but not correct. The other side is correct but not right. That's a beautiful saying, isn't it? So you have an argument with your wife, with your husband. Who's right and who's wrong? Yeah, one side is right but not correct. The other side is correct but not right. End of problem. In other words, we're both learning more. We're both taking it deeper. So, never feel diminished by an argument. Never think that it ends by proving one side is right and one side is wrong. The argument is passionate. It takes both people closer to being right. None of you are right. None of us is right. But we take the argument deeper. We learn more. We grow more. And that's why I loved those arguments in the pubs when I was at college. Passionate. And I would listen, the other person would listen, it was alive, it was interesting, we were engaged, and you know, some of the faults in my arguments were pointed out, I pointed out the faults in other person's arguments, we took it deeper, we learned more, we understood more. But, again, couched in this beautiful sense of friendship and mutual respect. So, that's what's missing. The respect and the understanding of arguments. We understand where they're coming from, different backgrounds, different conditionings, who's right, who's wrong. It's nothing about being right, being wrong. Totally where you've come from, where you've learned from, your life experiences, your parents, everything else. That's where your views and thoughts come from. They're not true, they're not original, they're not just coming from sort of, you know, the ultimate source of truth. They're totally conditioned. Now, understand where they come from. So, no right, no wrong, but we want to take it deeper. We understand what arguments are, where they come from, and couch them in passion, no, express them in passion, get into it, shout, be alive, but no right, no wrong, kindness before, kindness afterwards, acceptance and valuing the other person. Then we can engage in these incredible discussions. No one feels threatened. Why do you feel threatened in an argument? Because sometimes in our society, it's one of the worst conditionings. If you're wrong, you are hopeless. You are terrible. Isn't it bad? I'm a fool. I'm stupid. I don't know how many people have been called stupid at school. You know, just because you can't pass the exam or you can't get the test. Look at the facts of life. Steve Jobs got kicked out of... Oh, he actually left university. Einstein got kicked out of university. All the great people never finished university. That was my problem. I actually finished university. That's why I never got on in life. So, you know, who's a failure? And who's a success? So just because there's no such thing as being a loser... I think that word, you know, they use that in sort of the Westies days. Being a loser is one of the worst things in the world, isn't it? If someone calls you a loser, I mean, that's a pretty sort of, you know, bad sort of slur on your character, isn't it? But look, I admit I'm a loser. I've lost so much becoming a monk. I lost all my money, I lost my girlfriends, I lost all my possessions, I lost my motorbike, I had a really nice motorbike. So really, in this whole world, because now look at me, I just sleep on the floor, you know, I've just got no possessions, I've got no superannuation, I've got no TV, I've got no mobile phone, I've got nothing. You know, in this Australia, you know, I claim the title as the biggest loser. Because I'm not going so much. So why is it that people say, you're a loser? So people said, look at me, Ajahn Brahm, you're a loser. I said, yes, thank you so much. It's wonderful being a loser. Come and join me. Be a loser at Bodhinyana Monastery or Dharmasara Monastery. Lose everything. That's what Buddhism is all about. Letting go. Having few possessions. No attachments. Losing everything. Come on, be your biggest loser like me. So you can understand over there that a word like a loser has this connotation of being bad, but we actually change it around to make it sound something positive. Simply because, why do you think like that? It's because you've used the way you've been brought up, and our culture imposes these ideas on us, and we suck it, we buy into it, and that's why we have these views. So argue with these views, but we take them deeper when we argue. Be kind before, be kind afterwards, respect one another, and when you have that respect, arguments become a beautiful part of life. They're not something we avoid like a plague. They're not something we're afraid of engaging with other people in case, my God, I might upset them. Now how can I argue with an indigenous Australian when I think they're wrong? Because is that going to hurt them? Am I not respecting them? How can I engage, say, with a woman wearing a burqa? Is that going to upset her? Why can't we engage with each other and argue? And then actually from that argument, learn from each other. But always in couched in mutual respect and friendship. So it's the respect and friendship. That's the area where we should work on. So we have enough respect and friendship with one another that arguments can happen. And they can be wonderful arguments. So we learn so much. We can take the world to a much deeper level. We can grow. We can develop without sacrificing the compassion and love and friendship and harmony within our communities. Arguments will always be there. We don't need to get rid of arguments and just bite our lip or just say things which the other person wants to hear. No. Argue. But develop the friendship. I just was reading this article by Professor Gombrich. He was criticizing especially Theravada Buddhism and how it's got this beautiful message, but just the way it's been presented over the world, it's just been pathetic. And he was actually saying, just the job of a preacher, like me, is actually you've got two choices. You can comfort or you can challenge. You can tell people what they want to hear. And people afterwards, they go away saying, oh, they feel so comfortable. Yes, Buddhism is the best religion. And you've got the best type of Buddhism. And you've got the best monastery with the best teachers. And you're nice people. And it's wonderful. You don't have to do anything. You're good enough already. It's nice to be comforted, isn't it? But is that the job of a teacher? So the teacher should challenge also to take you deeper, to actually ask some tough questions, to make you feel uncomfortable sometimes. Why is that? To take you deeper. Just like at school, sometimes the best teachers would really challenge you, put you on the spot. I didn't like it, but you really understood afterwards. Asking you tough questions, making you just go beyond where you were comfortable, to the place where insight, knowledge and development actually happen. Not in comfort, that's laziness, but in challenge. So, today I haven't said, oh, don't argue with each other. I said, argue. I haven't said, just agree with everybody for the sake of harmony. I say, no, challenge, argue. Because arguments are important in life. It's where we grow, where we learn, where we can take the wisdom and practice, the knowledge, the stuff of our society to a deeper and better level. But to be able to do that, please have respect. Please have kindness with one another. Doesn't matter who that other being is. Perhaps it's easy for me because I've practiced like that for such a long time. Whenever I see anyone, whoever they are, just a person who's raped kids in a jail, to sort of presidents and everyone in between, I've looked at every one of those and saw beautiful things in them. I've established respect by not just seeing a person as a rapist, not just a person as a mass murderer. I just looked at a person and seeing their beauty. Now you can always see it if you look for it in anybody. If you had a hard time with your partner and about to get divorced, just go home and look at their beautiful part. It's there. You've got to look for it. And it's there and it's beautiful. You can respect people then. When you respect people, then you can have the argument. And then, with that mutual respect, the argument is not seen as a personal challenge. It's not seen as a put down. It's not seen as proving you're right and they're wrong. It's knowing we're both wrong. We need to get less wrong. Going closer to a truth. What a wonderful world that would be. You can have the deepest of arguments, passionate arguments, but always remember, whoever wins has to make the person a cup of tea afterwards. Not buy them a drink, we're Buddhist. Whatever it is. But end it with kindness. So similar to that sandwich method I keep on talking about. Whenever you sort of have to admonish someone at work. Yeah, tell them off. But tell them how much you appreciate them first of all. And tell them how much you value them afterwards. The sandwich method. That's exactly the same with arguments. Before you start the argument, establish friendship, establish compassion. After the argument, establish friendship, establish compassion. Then you know that you can talk about the most deepest of things. And that's, I think, why one of the great sayings of the Buddha says, I never argue with the world argues with me. What he really meant then. Never gets upset at the world. Arguments are part of the world. It's part of life. Accept them, use them, grow from them. The only problem is not that there are arguments, is we just don't know how to do them. Couched in kindness and respect. And then have a wonderful life. Interesting life. It's nothing like a good argument with someone. Around a coffee table, really going there. It's a beautiful way of spending. Much better than watching the TV or going to a movie. You get deeper, but afterwards, remember, establish that friendship. So there we go. Another talk on arguments. Has anyone got any questions about the talk today? Yes. Exactly. That's what you're saying. Unless you have the right emotional input there, in other words, so what I was saying about the friendship, the trust there, at the beginning and the end, even in the middle, then the argument can turn sour. The whole purpose of the talk here is exactly that. Not to avoid the arguments, because arguments are part of life. Differences are beautiful. As the French say, vive la différence. I don't think they meant what I meant by that, but one of my favourite sayings, when everyone thinks the same, no one thinks at all. That's a nice saying. When everyone thinks the same, no one thinks at all. So that's great to have those differences. But it's what you were saying there from a psychology perspective. Yes, it's the emotional sort of capital, I think you mentioned, invested into that argument. That is most important. Build up that friendship, build up that respect throughout the whole argument. And if you feel the other person's getting a bit upset, repeat it, reinforce, like, I respect you, you're a friend. Okay, and I'll always love you and care for you. Okay, now come on, let's carry on with the argument.
Ah. Made a contribution to the background thing, but in reality, a lot of the time, people actually don't make enough of a contribution, either in the argument or before the argument, to even pull it off.
Okay, to be able to put it off, you mean to make that contribution before and middle and afterwards, and that contribution of establishing that trust is really important. So you have to spend time beforehand, and especially time afterwards. That was a great thing with the drinks afterwards. You know, we wouldn't just sort of leave the pub, hey, you stupid idiot, you know, just argue with me like that. You stay behind and you re-establish the friendship to make sure it was there. So wouldn't it be wonderful if you did that with the different religions, different parties, and have a beautiful sort of lunch and dinner and coffee, and then let's go and meet in Parliament and debate the issue. And then afterwards, we can actually just have a nice lunch afterwards. You know, most politicians actually do that. They told me that, yeah, I mean, they sort of, you know, in public, they fight each other and call each other all sorts of names, but then they sort of go out for dinner afterwards. I remember, no, this, I don't mind saying he told me this, you know, the fellow who built our retreat centre, Jerry Hansen, you know, he had his fights with Kevin Reynolds, you know, with the union sort of representative. But he told me first, he said, oh yeah, and we have these fights, you know, for the media, but then we go out for dinner in the evening. I quite admired that. You know, the sort of, you know, what the newspapers say is mortal enemies, but, you know, then they sort of, oh, they have dinner again, they sort of establish a friendship. Because, you know, I think Kevin Reynolds realised that he needs these guys, because if he didn't have the punch-ups, you know, he wouldn't have the persona, he wouldn't get re-elected as head of the union. So thank you for having me. I might get into trouble for that. Anyway, but that's what they told me. Okay, so I think we can finish off now. So thank you for listening to arguments. Okay, one more question, quick. Yes, go on. Thank you, I think I'll end there. Now he's saying that to butter me up, now comes the argument. Okay, you're saying that some views, are they all come from conditioning, or do they all, some come from inspiration, insight? The view that they all come, well, they actually do all come from conditioning. Now that is an insight. That's right, yeah. Okay.